Hello, I'm Kelly Gardner, and you're listening to Imagining the Past. Imagining the Past is a sneak preview of some of the writers and issues showcased in this year's conference of the Historical Novel Society of Australasia. In Parramatta, New South Wales, from the 25th to the 27th of October 2019, the conference offers craft workshops and 2 days of panel sessions, interviews and conversations. It's for writers and readers of historical fiction. You'll hear from a huge range of authors: Jackie French, Paula Morris, Anna Campbell, Pamela Hart, Ali Elizadeh, Meg Keneally, Kate Forsyth, and many more. The weekend also features academic panels and demonstrations of historical weapons. You can find out more at hnsa.org.au. In this podcast series, I'll be talking to some of our conference guests about writing and reading historical fiction. Nicole Alexander is a fourth-generation grazier who returned to the family property near Moree in the 1990s and now manages the business. But she's also the author of 9 best-selling historical novels: The Bark Cutters, A Changing Land, Absolution Creek, Sunset Ridge, The Great Plains, Wild Lands, River Run, and An Uncommon Woman. Her latest, Stone Country, was published earlier this year. Nicole's novels, poetry, creative writing and genealogy articles have been published internationally, and she has a Master of Letters in creative writing. I wanted to sort of begin at the end, which is with your latest novel, Stone Country, which has just been published this year. Can you tell us a bit about it for those people who haven't read it yet?
Yes, absolutely. Well, it spans the period 1901 to 1940. It's set in both Adelaide, South Australia and the Northern Territory, and it follows the life of Ross Grant, and he's the second of 2 sons born into a wealthy Scottish family in Adelaide. And when the Great War breaks out, their father actually decides that it's the eldest boy, Alistair, who should enlist, because he thinks his favourite son will basically acquit himself far better on the field of battle than Ross ever could. Unfortunately, a couple of years into the war, and Alistair actually disappears and is then branded a deserter. Now, Ross's family are really shocked by Alistair's lack of honour, and in an effort to, I guess, literally restore their reputation in Adelaide society, they managed to coerce Ross into marrying Alistair's fiancée, Darcy. Now, this Ross does, but as you can imagine, extremely reluctantly, but he bargains over it, basically. So it's on the condition that he can fulfil one of his own ambitions, and that's to head north to the Territory, where his father actually has a cattle property. He's a land speculator that he purchased sight unseen a number of years prior. So during the course of the narrative, we literally see Ross torn between this woman that he's forced to marry and one he eventually meets and falls in love with, between personal desire and the constraints of family duty, and also between the state of his birth, South Australia, and then this new country that he literally, you know, decides to go to in the north, which ends up captivating his soul to a certain extent.
And I understand this was inspired by a story from your own family history?
Yeah, it was. So when I first started writing novels, I decided to draw on some of my own family history. The reason being is that I'm like a fourth generation grazier. So we settled in northwestern New South Wales in 1893. And my family had just been terrible hoarders, Kelly. So we've got all this material. You know, paddock books and station diaries from the sort of late 1890s on. And then we've got mail order catalogues and magazines that got to about the 1950s and 60s, that type of thing. So when I first went home to the bush about 22 years ago, initially it was only to go home for 12 months because my father asked me to go back, and I thought, well, I'll go back and give it a go, and I'm still involved in the business. But in that first 12 or 18 months, I was over in the old schoolhouse, which was has since been converted into extra accommodation for jackaroos, and I started going through these old chests, one of which my grandfather had actually taken over to the Great War. And inside it was all these, you know, archives from going back to sort of, you know, when they first arrived in that part of the world. And that got me thinking about perhaps using some of that you know, as meat for a novel, etc. And I've sort of gradually done that, depending on the era and, you know, I guess, and the narrative as well that I'm writing about. I've tried to use snippets of that in all of my novels. For me, it gives the work a lot more heart, but then it's also, you know, it's that absolute authenticity because it's primary source material. So it sort of becomes, it has become very vital to my work because I am very much orientated around Australia's pastoral history with all of my works.
So are there any challenges in that in terms of telling family stories? I mean, this is inspired by a family story, isn't it? It's not actually your grandfather didn't desert.
No, that's correct. So what I usually do is just take an idea and then see if it's going to work as far as the novel is concerned when I start doing my early research. But with this new book, Stone Country, I decided that I was going to have two brothers. And I'd worked out, obviously, the period was going to be 1901 to 1940, so obviously I was touching on the Great War and the beginning of the Second World War. And as I started thinking about it, it did remind me of my own family. So when a couple of years into the Great War, my paternal grandfather decided that he would actually enlist and fight at the front, whilst his younger brother would stay at home and basically look after the family farm and their mother, because their father had passed away quite early in 1903. So looking at that from the outside, I thought, well, that's quite logical, this sort of, you know, apportioning of responsibilities. One boy goes abroad and fights at the front and does his bit for the war, and the other boy stays at home. And he's contributing to the war effort because it was a sheep property. And, of course, during the war, the Great War, our wool was vital for the manufacture of uniforms. We were under contract to the UK as far as wool exports were concerned at that time. So, okay, that's quite logical. Then you take a step further back from that and you start thinking about decision from the younger boy's point of view who's been left at home. Obviously, there would be enormous guilt. He'd be worrying about this beloved brother that may or may not come back from the front at the same time. So when my grandfather enlisted, it was towards the end of 1916. So that's when all those dreadful reports, casualty reports, were coming in from the Somme. It was also a period when those men that hadn't enlisted, for whatever reason, some of them were being handed white feathers for cowardness. Now, there's no evidence in my family that that actually happened to my great uncle. But I have no doubt, you know, obviously he would have been probably recipient of some fairly derogatory comments, even if they were sort of, you know, expressed in a very joking manner. So when my grandfather returned from the war, he was actually a decorated hero. My great uncle, on the other hand, became an alcoholic very early in life and died very early in life.
Mm.
So from the point of view of Stone Country, Ross is the boy that's told that he has to stay behind. And the ramifications of that decision that's made on his behalf and how it affects him during the course of his lifetime and the guilt that haunts him really sort of makes up sort of this backstory to Stone Country and Ross's life. So it's drawing on those, I guess, stories that have come down through my family and then obviously tweaking them. So as you say, I don't sort of write per se about my family history, although I am tossing up about doing something like that. But at the moment with my novels, no, it's if I think of something or I read something and I think, well, I could use that here because it's the right period, then certainly I do consider it.
Mm. Actually, I think it was Robert Menzies or someone like that had a very similar experience. He was sat down by his parents and they said, okay, you're staying and your brothers are going. And he felt that guilt and terrible responsibility during the war, but then guilt forever after.
Well, I think the guilt, you know, haunted a lot of men and you know, and many of them stayed, you know, didn't enlist for various reasons. The first couple of years of the Great War, the army were actually turning down men just for having the medical condition of being plasters flat-footed, for heaven's sake. But, of course, a couple of years into the war and that all changes and the army's just happy to take anybody who's willing to enlist. But, you know, men stayed behind to contribute to the war effort, whether it be working in manufacturing industries or on properties, etc. You know, there's a lot that's been written about men fighting abroad and the women and children that sort of stay at home and take on the roles of men, etc. And I've written about that myself in previous novels. But not so much about those men that stay behind and what happens to them when they stay behind. And people's attitudes at the time as well towards men that didn't enlist. Quite extraordinary, the negativity. But I guess there's so much loss and sadness And, you know, people were just overcome with, why is my son going? Why has he been maimed, or why has he died? When you're still here and you're not doing your bit. So it becomes a very emotive issue. And I have to be honest and say, I did toss up whether I was going to sort of use that. But then I thought, well, it's only representative of probably X number of other hundreds of people that would have had the same experience in Australia at the time. So, you know, why not?
Hmm. And you were saying how you come from a long line of graziers, and your books are usually set in rural areas, often on big stations or in places that other people would consider remote, even if the people who live there don't consider them remote necessarily. And I was wondering how your own life, managing the business, being on the farm, growing up in the country, how that influences what you write now, even when the story is set in a different time.
I think, you know, I sort of literally grew up. People say to me, what was it like growing up in the bush? And I always think, well, I grew up with the sky for a ceiling and my backyard was the horizon. We did correspondence school. Mum used to teach us around the dining room table, because by that stage, that's when the Jackaroo's quarters had sort of, you know, the old school house had been converted into Jackaroo's quarters. So we had this sense of freedom. So, you know, if we could rush through our lessons during the day after we got through, you know, the coursework that had been sent up from Sydney, then we could have an early mark and we'd be out the back door by 2 o'clock. And we were always outside doing things. We were building things, building go-karts, crashing them, swimming in the creek, fishing, exploring and observing the animals and the wildlife. And then when I first came back to the bush for that initial 12 months and then stayed basically for what seems the rest of my life, you're always very aware of being observant. You know, you're observing the environment around you, you're observing the condition of your livestock, the pasture growth, you know, what the trees are like, etc. So you're always very observant when you're living and working on the land. And I think, you know, all writers, as you well know, are very observant people. We have to be, I think. And I think that being, you know, having that rural background probably even makes it more so, because that sort of leads in, I guess, to the fact that the environment does play a big part in a lot of my stories, because I like to contrast that and I like to sort of pit the character against the landscape that he's living in or travelling through at the time.
Well, a place is almost a character in your book, so I would have
thought. Yeah, absolutely. And I guess it's not like I set out to do that intentionally. It's just that, you know, I love Australia and I love our landscapes, and I really like the idea of celebrating our landscapes and all that diversity as part of the novel. I mean, it's only the background to the story, but for me it's so much about, you know, the story unfolding on this, you're sort of in like a very rich tapestry, if you like. So that's vital to me. And, you know, the land is a living, breathing thing. So it's right that it should be portrayed as a character. That works for me, obviously, with my novels, because I am writing about Australia's pastoral history. So the land and the environment plays a big part in that, particularly in the formation of Australia's characters going back 100, 200 plus years. So I guess it is very much a character in my work.
So I was thinking when you were talking before too that that observant, the long-term observations that you can make of places where you've grown up. But then for Stone Country, I understand, you had to actually go to places and explore them with different eyes, with an outsider's eyes. Do you approach writing about place then differently, or do you see different things, or do you have to, you know, if you're just going somewhere and you're walking on country that you're not familiar with, how does that observation happen for you, and how do you capture what you're seeing or what you're hearing or smelling or feeling?
Okay, so with all my novels, I've always travelled to the place I'm going to be writing about. So I've been over to France for the novel that was, you know, regarding the First World War. I've been to America when I sort of went off into a little bit of American history and bringing that back into Australia's pastoral history. So it's just, for me, it's vital to be able to get out to the landscape and walk around in it. I literally want to see the difference in the light. I want to smell, see and hear all the changes that are happening around me, and then hopefully through that personal lens be able to capture it and transpose it down onto the page. So then when the reader opens one of my books, they can literally be immersed in that same environment. So I usually, like, so with Stone Country, I researched in both state libraries in South Australia and the Territory, and then I spent time out in the bush as well. So I was in the mid-north of South Australia, and then I camped out in Kakadu National Park for 5 nights with my guide in December, which was a really bad time to go, Kelly.
Not advisable.
Because of the humidity, obviously, but, you know, it was just a timing thing.
Although then you bring the humidity into the exactly. into the book. It's a feature.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So there, and everything about the top end, you know, well, Australia in general, as we know very much at the moment, is controlled by the weather. But in the top end, you have the wet and the dry season. So if you're on a light, you know, a very isolated run, trying to run a business, you can't be moving around in February because depending on where you are, you're probably going to be flooded in. So leading up to the monsoon season, it's called suicide season. And it was coined suicide season in the 1800s. Everybody thinks it's quite a recent phrase. But I wanted to get out there and experience that because obviously that would have a huge effect on the characters. If they are sitting inside a house with no radio, nothing, no mail, rereading newspapers and books that hopefully hadn't been white-anted at the time, and going through that relentlessness of just continual rain for 3 or 4 months. And then, of course, that all finishes and you have, you know, all this lush growth that's grown over that period starts to drop onto the ground and you have these big storms that come in from the east across from Arnhem Land, from the ocean. It's called the knock-em-down season. And all the winds come in and basically knock down the speargrass that can grow 10 feet high, etc. So I need to understand that if my characters are travelling through that area. So there's no way I would ever attempt to write a book that can do justice to a story that involves pastoral Australia if I haven't seen the country, because it's just everything is controlled by the weather and the landscapes when you're in the bush. And I guess that goes back to your earlier question about how my upbringing, I suppose, has to an extent moulded me and affected me as a writer, because the landscape is now so very important in the majority of my works.
Yes, we were talking about country as character, but it's also, in that example of the wet, you have plot points around it, don't you? You know, the misunderstanding when Ross arrives at Waybell and he thinks that people have been incompetent because they haven't been grazing on certain country, but it's just that he's not understanding the difference between the wet and the dry and the difference that it makes to certain parts of this enormous place that he's never been before.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was another reason why I also had to go and, you know, spend time there and walk around in that area. And you literally have to see, I mean, Kakadu in December, that was the end of 2017 when I went up there. And there'd been a little bit of rain, and a little bit of rain for them means it's still, you know, as green as Ireland, basically. It's extraordinary, you know, the colours up there, and the wet season hadn't even started properly. But you're just so aware of what's around you, and then you actually have to see past that, see past the beauty and say to yourself, okay, if I was living here, if I arrived here for the first time and it's the 1920s, I go, wow, this is great. And I think, you know, from Ross's point of view, he's a very naive young man who thinks he knows and understands everything, whereas, you know, it's that, I guess, sort of, you know, journey of the character into the unknown world and, you know, trying to get used to all the changes and the challenges that are involved with that. But then from him first arriving there and looking past the beauty that's actually around him and really starting to understand a place and get to know the fact that, you know, he has no control here. He's actually being curtailed by the weather. Everybody is curtailed by the weather.
Can we talk a bit about him? Because he's not an easy man to live with, is he, or be around for the long stretches of the book, for the people around him. Oh, he's complex, you know, and he's learning, as you say. He's on a path of growth. So how did you go about creating that character, and what did you want him, how did you want him to appear to readers throughout the book?
When I first started thinking about Ross and crafting him, this one word kept coming into my head, which was duality. You know, so duality is, you know, good and bad, war and peace, love and hate, that type of thing. But I was specifically looking at the duality of human nature, the good and the bad. And those decisions that we make during a lifetime and our reactions to other things that happen around us that can really make us take the right path or the wrong path in life. So I really wanted to explore Ross's choices regarding his decision making, bearing in mind that even, you know, the novel spans a period of 40 years, but he's a child at the beginning of the work. So, and he dies when he's quite young in the story. Sorry, that's a spoiler.
Spoiler.
For the listeners. That's a spoiler for everybody. But yes, yeah, so I was very much aware that I was really looking at a character who was growing up during the course of the novel with not having had a lot of guidance from his parents during his lifetime, because they were quite, you know, I'm far more interested in the eldest boy, Alistair, because I thought he had a lot more to offer across all spectrums. So it was very much about, you know, having Ross literally on a high wire, as if he was a circus performer, and if he was going to be able to keep his balance during his lifetime, or if at some stage he was going to redeem himself if and when he did fall. So I sort of took the view that everybody has a, you know, it's like this tipping point in their lives where something happens and it throws us off track, and it's how we actually do react to that that can then affect, you know, affect us as an individual, or perhaps our family and close friends as well. So I was very much conscious of constructing a character like that, which I suppose, as reviewers have said to me, it makes him a very gritty character and someone we don't necessarily like at times. But he does have his redeeming qualities. And it just made for, I think, quite a different novel to what I've written previously, I suppose, to a certain extent, because I am centred on one man, one man's point of view, one man's, you know, pitfalls and the more positive aspects in his life.
Mm. And a man of his generation, clearly, and so one of the and the people around him too. So one of the issues that you raise in your author's note in Stone Country is the difficulty of writing from the point of view of people in the past who are so clearly racist. That in this case, the people who believe in the White Australia policy and were dispossessing Aboriginal people, and so you've noted that as something that you kind of warn people about that, don't you, in your author's note. So how did you approach that? How did you think about how to put some of those often problematic ideas and words into the characters' voices?
Well, I just took the view, as far as Indigenous Australians were concerned, they, and remain so, crucial to the running of a lot of those big properties up north. They're needed for labour, but of course back in the, you know, 1900s, either side of the century, we had tribes then living on those runs, and they had to be cared for and looked after. And there's numerous stories, the negative aspects regarding the treatment of Indigenous Australians, and the very positive, you know, sort of strong relationships that were formed between those Indigenous Australians that worked on these runs and the managers slash owners who were, you know, in charge of them. So I think the only thing I could do was try and just give a fair and honest portrayal based on what I'd read without, I suppose, getting into that messy area of appropriating from another culture or people. And that was one of the reasons I thought too that when I was crafting the character of Maria, who is part Chinese in the story, that allowed me to buy into, obviously, the negativity associated with the White Australia policy. But then also at the end of the Great War, when we had, you know, the League of Nations formed, and the peace treaties were drawn up, the abolition of slavery was on sort of, you know, those the top pointers of things that needed to be addressed at the end of the war. So that allowed me, without giving another spoiler away, to sort of, look at, I guess, Maria's character from a different viewpoint without getting too caught up, once again, into the appropriation side of things.
One of the difficulties for anybody writing about that time is to balance that. Here we are, we're presenting characters who are racist. They are, you know, various people in your story, and towards various people as well, including some of the treatment of Maria in particular, but just the way she's positioned. To the modern reader, it is shocking.
It is. I think
probably. We hope it's shocking anyway. So, you know, it's that balancing of presenting it, but presenting it in a light so that it is still shocking.
Well, yes, that's right. I guess the thing is, too, when you're writing historical fiction, one would hope that when people are reading books like this, that they know that you're looking at this information with the prevailing attitudes at the time. So that was one of the reasons why I mentioned, you know, White Australia policy, et cetera, you know, in the author's notes, because I wanted to have that disclosure there so people knew what they, you know, were basically going to be, or why it was in there in the first place. For me, it's really important when I'm writing about rural Australia that authenticity is 100%, that the realism is there. And yes, that might tweak a few people's nerves, but I am writing about the past, but it is our history. And I'm a firm believer in learning from the past in order to move forwards into the future. And a lot of people don't know what's happened on some of these stations in the past, and certainly with one of my other books, Wildlands, that briefly covered the Myall Creek Massacre. And once again, it was important to me to give a fair and balanced account on both sides, you know, both sides of the story. So I guess as far as attitudes towards racism, you know, et cetera, and a character's points of view, et cetera, that would be my sort of, you know, standard comment that I would keep saying to you, that I am really trying to you know, be true to those prevailing attitudes from the period that I'm writing about, good or bad. And if it pushes buttons, maybe that's a good thing, because it sort of makes people think about the treatment of different groups over the course of Australia's history.
Mm. So how do you get your head inside those, the worldview of your characters, of the people in the past, and the voices too? So you were talking about the materials that you had from your farm and material that you found in the state libraries. Can you have access to letters and diaries so that you can read yourself into their sort of minds and values and the voices? And then how do you translate that onto your page?
Yes, well, I did read sort of like a lot of, particularly up in the Northern Territory, I read a lot of journals and just, I guess you'd say, family history snippets. I'm a big fan of just reading generally about family history from different areas I'm setting a work in. But the things I read about in Darwin pertaining to the Chinese was fascinating, because Darwin, being a port city up until about the 1920s, had a massive Chinatown. And, of course, being a port city, the unions were very strong, loading and unloading steamships. There was Vestey's Meatworks, which was an English company, but it was run by unions. You had tin gold mines run by unions. So you have the unions fighting against the Chinese and really trying to hold up the mandate for the White Australia policy, because they don't want the Chinese coming in and undercutting prices and taking jobs away from white Australians, basically. So from reading those sort of histories, it wasn't hard for me to get a general sense of the feelings of the Chinese in Darwin at that time, and also some of the animosity they felt. But also the huge contribution that the Chinese have made to Darwin and continue to make in Darwin as well. So I guess from there it was sort of reading a myriad voices and then funneling them down into one, and then obviously putting my own spin if we talk about Maria specifically. And that's the same with all the characters. I literally was just reading generally about pastoral history of each area, South Australia and the Northern Territory, and then looking once again specifically at sort of regional and then family histories in different areas and getting points of view. And then I would basically go on one of my very long walks that I tend to take and then try and construct a character in my head. Usually it happens when I sort of start writing, and then the characters develop more and more as I go. Well, I guess, you know, like any other author, they become fixed in your head, don't they? And that's when you sort of you get that, you know, light bulb moment. You go, yes!
We hope so.
We hope so.
Okay, so just in terms of process then, so you do a lot of your research at the beginning and then you start writing. Is that how it works?
Yeah, it does, most definitely. So I read very generally on the area, areas, depending on the novel, obviously, that I'm going to be, that I'm looking at writing about. And then once I've decided on a specific location and the era, then I really hone in on those regional and family histories. I do a lot of general reading before I start writing, and then once I start writing, I try and sort of, you know, stay away from the research material, because otherwise I'm fascinated by it, so I just get bogged down in it.
That's the danger, isn't it?
Oh, it is, absolutely, because it's so easy to do it, isn't it? So yes, and then I sort of only search for information as I need it once I start writing. Most of my research trips I tend to do before I start writing as well, because I like to have that background work done in my head, basically. I usually take a lot of photographs when I'm out in the field, and then that allows me to sort of, you know, I make rough notes as well, but it's the photos that really sort of stick in my mind when I go back to writing, and obviously it's easy to refer back to those as well too. And that once again then helps with characterisation, you know, the viewpoint of the character looking at this new place he's come to, etc., as far as Stone Country is concerned. But yes, so the majority of my research is always done before I start writing, although this year on this current book I'm working on, it's been a bit of an aberration because I couldn't actually do one of the trips until July. So that made things a little bit difficult, but it's, you know, it's always fitting everything in, isn't it? There's no perfect world scenario when it comes to being a writer.
Unfortunately, no. So tell us a bit about that. What are you working on at the moment?
So it's a dual narrative, which I haven't done for a while now, and it's going to be set in the Richmond Valley in northern New South Wales and also in the Strzelecki Desert on the South Australian-New South border. So that's where the most recent trip was, a week out in the Strzelecki Desert, which is fascinating.
What kind of desert is it?
Rolling red dunes, just rolling red dunes with this, you know, stunted growth. And, of course, you know, it's always dry out there, but roaring drought happening as well at the same time this season. So it's just an extraordinary... I've said that Kakadu was a very spiritual place. I've said that previously to people because there seems to be so much heart there. Strzelecki is in a totally different way, because when you get out to those places, you know, invariably your mobile phones don't work, there's no noise, you're just surrounded by this void of you know, there's no sound apart from the wind or birds, etc. And, you know, just sitting on a dune and just looking around you and you sort of take the view, what would have been like if I'd been living here even 50 years ago when people were still fighting off, you know, dingoes? People were doing the boundary rides along the dingo fence instead of driving around in their, you know, air-conditioned four-wheel Land Cruisers, which they do today. So that was the last research trip. So, yes, yeah, set in Richmond Valley and the Strzelecki Desert. Going to span the period 1867 to about 1950, and it brings that in that, you know, Irish angst, the Irish press coming out to Australia, the difficulties between the orange men and the green men, and also how that can then, you know, affect generations down into a family and those that perhaps marry into it as well, when you have those grudges that are held through the generation.
Fascinating. And what will this book be called, do you know?
Well, we don't have a title yet. I'm calling it book number 10, which is very original, isn't it?
But it's a lovely round number.
It is. And when someone asked me, you know, what I was going to call it a couple of days ago at the festival I was out, and I just thought, well, book number 10. Wow, I've written 10 books. How did that happen? So, yeah.
You've written 10 books and, you know, been managing a huge property and everything else in life as well. How do you balance all that?
With extreme difficulty is the short answer. Look, it took me 8 years to write my first book. I had a collection of poetry published during that time. I did a master's in literature and creative writing. I'd gone home for the first time and I thought, you know, and I'd been writing other stuff like short stories and poetry and whatever, and I just decided I'd try my hand at a full-length piece of fiction. And because I was determined to do it, I started writing weekends, evenings, whenever I had a spare moment. And the busier I got, I guess, the more I tended to have to write on the weekends and the evenings, and I just got into that habit. So it's sort of kept on from that. But it has meant that I've had to give up an awful lot. As terms, you know, in the early years, social life, etc., because I was very dedicated to trying to learn my craft and obviously keep learning my craft as well. So I guess that's what has kept me going. And also, I think it's a great privilege to be published in Australia. But for me, I guess because of my background, it's also a great honour to be able to write about your pastoral, you know, Australia's pastoral history, something that your own family's been involved in. and have people want to read that and share those stories, even if they are, you know, fictionalised accounts, and get a greater understanding of what's beyond, you know, the range, what's in that great interior, because it's such a, there's such a diverse culture in the bush. You know, we have farmers and graziers and new business owners and settlers coming in, and Australia's First People, and, you know, immigrants, a whole potpourri. And, you know, you could be talking about Australia now or Australia 160 years ago, because all that same intrigue and romanticism, I guess, and mystery, which for me is almost as defined but also as unknowable, if I can say this, is the Southern Cross, you know, that for me makes great stories. So I just take the view that, you know, pastoral history should be the stuff of good narrative tales, if possible.
Well, we're looking forward to book 10, book number 10.
Looking forward to finishing it, Kelly.
Well, I'm sure you will. And we're also looking forward to seeing you at the conference in October.
Yes, it'll be lots of fun. I'm looking forward to it. It's a great conference.
It is. So thank you for taking time to talk to us today, and we'll see you in October at the conference.
Super. Thank you so much, Kelly. I do appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to Imagining the Past. It's a showcase of some of the writers in this year's conference of the Historical Novel Society of Australasia. In Parramatta, New South Wales, from the 25th to the 27th of October, the conference offers craft workshops and 2 days of panel sessions, interviews and conversations for writers and readers. You can find the 2019 conference program, book tickets and listen to more episodes of Imagining the Past at hnsa.org.au.